Hello and welcome to SciLax, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg, as usual, proudly powered by Research Luxembourg. And in today's show, we have this time Tim Huber, who is Senior R&D Associate at LIST. Tim holds a PhD degree in materials engineering, and he conducts research in the area of novel bio-based and sustainable materials and product development. Tim, thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So LIST, as usual, is challenging me because we often talk materials with LIST and then it's a podcast, so we can't show anything. So it's on you to describe the materials well, you know, you realize that because the listeners cannot see things. But yes, we'll be talking a lot about material science, of course, and materials and what you're developing at LIST and everything else. But of course, listeners already know I always like to set the scene and start with the basics. So material science, what are the current trends nowadays when we look at materials?
That is a very big question, of course. But at least in my area, obviously, there is a very strong focus now on sustainable materials, materials that can be recycled, that will be recycled, and materials that are generally non-harmful to the environment and to people. So everything that we call green chemistry, and all of this is, in Europe at least, is largely powered by the European Green Deal. It's an initiative by the European Union where there is a strong push towards sustainable materials in the broadest terms.
So we will be talking a lot about sustainability. So I have a problem with this word because I have a feeling that people love using it, but then it's not exactly the same thing we mean when we say that. So when we say sustainable material, say that's a material that you can recycle, or it's a material that is using sustainable materials to be created.
I have the very same problem, and I often ask people what they mean when they say sustainable. In this context of the material research that I do, what we typically mean, it's a material that's made from a renewable resource. So that's very important. So that means whatever you make the material from cannot be depleted by using more and more of the material. Now, typically, this means bio-based materials. There's lots of bio-resources available, but it can also be a material that can be recycled to some extent. The problem with recycling is that many materials cannot be recycled indefinitely. So that means with every time you recycle them, the properties get a little bit worse, and that limits the application range for those materials. But there are, of course, new research developments in that area as well. So this is typically in the most simple way is what we mean, a material that does not deplete the resources that we currently have on the planet.
And how many materials are there to choose from that don't deplete? I have a feeling that not that many.
No, that is not correct, I would say. So, for example, you asked me, you know, to provide you with a PubQuiz question. And my first question, not the one that I will ask, was what do you think is the most produced polymer? A polymer in the broadest term is what we call a plastic in the world. Do you have any idea what that might be?
No idea.
It's cellulose. So the world, as in nature, produces about 120 trillion tons of cellulose every year. So cellulose is the polymer, is the little building block that makes up every plant. So grass, wood, flowers, and so on. And we make paper from it, right? Everyone's very familiar. We make cardboard from it, but you can make loads and loads of different things from it. And we used to, before we started inventing man-made polymers, so you things like polypropylene, polyethylene, and all the other slightly more complicated ones, we made a lot of stuff out of cellulose, and we can do that again. It's just a matter of price, of scaling, and potentially of optimizing the processing, right? And then there, of course, there's other things that nature provides us with. There is a lot of animals, for example, they use a material called chitin or chitosan. So all insects, and we have a lot of insects, they make their outer shell out of this material, chitin. All sea creatures that are not fish, they typically reinforce their shell with hydroxyapatite. That's a type of calcium. And again, those materials all have lots and lots of different properties, and they are available in abundance, you know. So it's a matter of using those correctly and finding the right applications for it that's currently holding us back. It's not the availability of the material.
So what you're saying is when we say plastic, it actually is not always bad.
No, plastic is certainly not always bad. What's bad about plastic is the way we're using it. If you think about the COVID pandemic that we all had to live through, it would have been a disaster without plastic. You know, plastic is very useful for keeping food safe. It's very useful for single-use things like syringes and all of this. And this is incredibly difficult to make out of other materials. So for those, plastics are fantastic. What we're not doing very well is we're not sorting our plastic very well, and we use it for not long enough. A lot of effort goes into making a piece of plastic. I know it doesn't look like it. It often looks a bit flimsy and cheap. But it isn't, you know. There's a lot of work that went into this. And then we use it for 5 minutes and then we throw it away. And we don't think about it after we've thrown it away either. In Luxembourg, sure, we do a bit of recycling and people try very hard, I know. But the numbers of plastics that do get recycled is shockingly low. Shockingly low. And so for this, it's a waste. We're wasting the plastic, but it's certainly not a bad material. Not at all.
So does it mean that we don't have the technology to use more plastic, or we just should use less plastic and throw it away?
We should use it differently, I think. First of all, we should have clear recycling guidelines for every citizen so that you know what you need to do with the plastic. And I think Valalux is doing a good job in Luxembourg at trying to make it as clear as you can. But it's still complicated. Every day, often I see people in our canteen looking at their plastic container and not sure in which bin to put it, right? This is a problem we need to solve. What we also need to solve is, I guess, the way we are incentivizing the recycling. So for you and me, there is almost no difference if we put a piece of plastic in the rubbish bin or in the recycling bin. And the same, unfortunately, holds true for big companies, you know. So they make no money off recycling their materials. And maybe we need to change that, you know. Maybe it needs to be useful and valuable to recycle your materials rather than a punishable offense to not do it. People don't work very well. I think if you just punish them for doing the wrong thing, you need to give them the opportunity to do the right thing and make it easy for them to do so. And that is certainly things we can work on and we need to work on, but it will cost time and it will cost money.
It's a big challenge. I even, you know, remember that in the previous apartment where I lived, I think the biggest fights we ever had was about waste and bins and who throws what and where and how. And especially as we do have a lot of foreigners coming in, you know, whenever you move countries, you actually need to learn once again what to do with each and every piece of waste that you're throwing away.
Exactly. My mother-in-law was, or my parents-in-law were over for Christmas. And they've been over a few times and they come from England. And people do recycle in England, but they do it differently. And so, of course, nobody tells anyone off, but it takes a long time to realize which thing to put into which colored bin, because of course we use the same colors, but for different things in different countries. So it's very confusing to the average person. And you can't blame people for getting it wrong.
Yes, before we focus more on the science part of our meeting today, you already teased that you were preparing a pub quiz question. And you said, okay, I had this one in mind, but then I had something else. So can you please tell us, listeners and me as well, what is your question? And listeners, remember the answer only at the end of the podcast.
So as you mentioned, I also work in product development and I have worked a lot with product designers. So my question is, how many products do you think fail because of poor material selection in the product design process?
Thank you. Great question. And we'll be discussing the answer only at the end of the podcast. So now let's move on a little bit deeper into the field. And I wanted to just start with material selection exactly. So how are they selected? We don't want to say why they fail and how many fail, but how are they selected? The process.
Typically, when you work with a designer or a design engineer, they have an idea for a product they want to develop. And so this product has what we call product specifications. So it does a certain thing for a certain amount of time to a certain level of excellence, right? So this is essentially the three pillars we build a product on. And for all of those, you can come up with product design specifications. So for example, you say this table needs to be able to hold a load of 200 kilos, for example. And so this means with this set of specifications, you can look up a big table of data that is available. There is software that does it for you. Of course, there's lots of textbooks where you can look this up. And in there are all the materials that we currently know of that can be purchased. Of course, there's many more materials that are developed by people like myself that are not publicly available. But all the ones that are, you can look up their properties. And so you basically make a list of all the materials that tick all your boxes, and then you come up with a shortlist. And the good news is, if you are a good designer, you write those design specifications in a way that at the end of your selection process, you maybe have 5 or 6 materials left and not 50 or 60,000. And then you have to choose. And this is the really tricky part, because now we're reaching the area of what do you like? Of course, some of it is governed by cost, but typically you have eliminated the too expensive materials at the beginning. So now it's a question is, do I like the material more that looks a bit like a piece of wood, or do I like a material more that looks a bit like a spaceship? You know, so what message do you want your product to tell? What audience is it supposed to appeal to? All of those are decisions that are less easy to measure. And so for this, it's up to the designer to make the decision he or she thinks is correct.
And is it the moment when you also try to, I don't know, do some A-B tests or whatever you check with your future customers, or this is still in the hands of the designer?
Typically, this is the point where you should at least do small scale testing. So you make different prototypes and you test those prototypes. So you give them to people, normally a select group. You observe how they interact with them. You ask them pointed questions and open questions to find out how they feel about the product as a whole. What do they like? What don't they like about it? And of course, there's also a huge range of standardized testing for longevity, for durability, for performance. But at that point, you really need to be sure that you already have the right material, because those tests are expensive.
Of course. When I was reading one of your papers, I noticed two interesting features. Let's say one was desirability and the other one distinguishability. So what are they and why are you discussing it in material design?
So this comes from the general idea. So this will be a slightly longer explanation. I'm sorry. That we found that with the materials that I work with, so bio-based materials and sustainable materials, they've been around for a while. You know, it's not a new development. It certainly has gained momentum recently, but we've been trying to put those materials in the market for 20, 30 years or so. And the success is limited. Let's put it that way. And the question was, why is this? You know, especially now, if you ask Generation Z and the millennials, what do you care about? And they care about sustainability. And they say they're willing to pay more for sustainable materials. So the old barrier, which was cost, should have been removed by this change in customer attitude. But if you again look at the sales numbers, the sales are not really increasing. And so we wanted to know, why is this? And what we found is that really people have a hard time knowing what a sustainable material is. There is obviously is a lot of what we call greenwashing going on, where companies tell you, no, we're doing the right thing. Our material is good for the environment. We won't tell you why, but we will tell you it is. And people obviously have no choice other than believe it or not believe it. People get disappointed by those promises because they later find out it was all, you know, smokes and mirrors. And so we wanted to find out, how can we help people with this? And so this is where those two terms come into place. So to make a material identifiable by a customer, so imagine you stand in a shop, or if you wanted an expensive product in a showroom of a car reseller, and you're interested in purchasing a new car, but you want one that uses and supports natural materials, then the only option you have is looking at the material. Sometimes you can interact with the material, but if you do your shopping online, you can't even touch it, feel it, smell it. So you need to be able to look at the material and know that this material is a bio-based or a sustainable material. So this is what we looked at. This is what we call the distinguishability. Desirability, then on the other end, is, of course, knowing that the material is bio-based and sustainable doesn't make you want to buy the product that uses the material. The material also needs to look nice. It needs to feel nice. It needs to give you the feeling that this is the thing I want to spend my money on, not the other thing. Products are competing with each other every time somebody makes a purchasing decision. And so desirability makes products succeed. And we wanted to know if we can do improved is through material design.
Isn't there a problem of people looking at the material and thinking, okay, this is sustainable because it is not so desirable, if I could say that? I mean, we have a feeling, the color, right? Okay, if it's kind of brownish, creamish, then probably it's some sustainable material.
Yeah, that does happen. We think this comes from the fact that when we go out in nature, we see a very typical color palette, right? Brown, sometimes green, a little bit of gray, some blue. But that's it. Well, if you look at, if I look around us currently, I see bright orange, you know, I see dark black, shiny things, glossy things. And those are things we don't typically find in nature. So we have a predisposition to assume if something's slightly brown, slightly green, it is probably more natural. The problem with this is what we often like is shiny and glossy and maybe brightly colored. So how to marry those two things is a challenge, of course. But not every material that is sustainable needs to be brown. Not every material that is bio-based needs to look like it's been made from a hemp sack, you know? So there is, of course, opportunities for a material engineer and a material designer to change the appearance of those materials at some point. But the question is, what do you make them look like for them to be appealing? I wonder if this is a decision that should be left to the engineers. And I think, and I don't want to insult my engineering friends, none of them are particularly interested in aesthetics. None of them are particularly interested in beauty and desirability. So maybe this is a decision we need to make together with other people.
And that leads us to the question, can a sustainable material be beautiful? I think you're saying yes, absolutely.
I say yes, absolutely, because I believe in my research. If you want to scrutinize this answer, then of course we don't know a lot of things yet, right? But what we have found is that when we ask people, we gave material samples to people, and you have to imagine it's a small square. So it doesn't have a particular shape. So we wanted people to really focus on the material, not on the shape it has, not on the product it will be used at. And we asked them, do you find this desirable? Do you find this natural? Do you find this beautiful? And we asked for other attributes as well. And we find, yes, we have some materials that are highly desirable and they're nonetheless fully sustainable, while others are very non-desirable. So there's a very interesting sample that we looked at, which is a material that was developed by a big car manufacturer. I won't say which one because it's not really relevant. And they invested years into developing this material. And so a typical problem that the engineers had when processing is if you add this fiber to the polymer and you process it and shape it, means you have to heat it up, the fiber changes color. It turns from a lovely white to a darkish, dullish brown. It wasn't very good looking. So they invested a lot of money into optimizing the process to retain the original color of the fiber. And they managed. They were very, very pleased with this. They put it in a whole car prototype. The car never went anywhere for different reasons. We do not know why. That was never disclosed. But what we do know is we took this material and we gave it to students. And we asked them, what does this look like to you? And the answers we got is, this looks like my grandmother's old sofa. This looks like frozen vomit. This looks like something a dog's chewed up. And if you're the engineer who spent years and years and probably millions of euros developing this material, this would be heartbreaking to you, right? But that's the reality. The consumer, the customer of tomorrow has those opinions about the appearance. So you have to be very careful to select the right appearance as well as the right properties.
Not only that, but also what you said before, the fact that we tend to buy more and more online. So a lot of properties are actually not even an added value anymore because you can't touch what you're seeing on the flat screen.
That's correct. So there we also found some very interesting things because when we started this research, we were in the middle of the pandemic. So there was absolutely no chance of handing samples to people and getting them back or even talking to them in one room. So what we had to do is we had to take photos of our samples and ask people in an online survey to rate them. And so one of the samples we used is a fiber called coir. Coir is made from coconut. So not the brown outer of the nut, but the green thing that is around that. So if you process this, it turns into a dark brown, very coarse fiber. And if you mix that with a resin material, a resin is a hard material that is transparent. You see this coarseness of the fiber. It's very beautiful from my point of view anyway, and people generally agree. And you can see it. And when people just look at it, they think this material feels very rough because you see the coarse fiber in the transparent resin. Now, when you touch the material, it's very smooth because the resin is smooth, you know. It's a hard plastic, so it doesn't, you don't feel the fiber at all because it's embedded in the resin. And so, of course, there we get a huge discrepancy between what people rate the material as when they see it compared to when they get to see and touch it. And so those are things that you need to keep in mind.
Of course. And then the shock when you order something and it actually is completely different.
If you're terribly disappointed, you will never order this again, right? So this is a thing I think is probably currently underrated in the design process, is what does the product look like online compared to how does the product look when you have it in front of you?
Unless one day we actually develop certain touch screens where you can also touch the type of a product. And I know that Lise, I think, is working on something like that too.
Yeah, and I worked together with some people in New Zealand when I still worked there on exactly this. But I think it's safe to say we are many years away from simulating human touch.
Yes, let's not go there. Then many years away. So maybe in many years' time, we're going to meet again and we'll be talking about that. But now let's focus on now and the materials. So you're very clear. I understood everything. But when you start reading about your research, there are a couple of different terms that I want our listeners to understand, because you kind of use them interchangeably and sometimes not. And I really like the fact that you try not to use them, so it's clear, but I still have to ask. So we're talking about polymers and we're talking about composites.
So a polymer, in a very broad sense, is essentially just a very long chain of single units called a monomer. So a monomer could be, for example, from a chemical point of view, a few carbon atoms combined with hydrogen atoms. If you string them up in a very long chain, you have made a polymer out of this monomer. All plastics that we know are polymers. Not every polymer is what you would call a plastic, but the other way around, it certainly stands true. And then within the realm of polymers, we typically distinguish between two types of polymers. There's thermosets. So that's a type of resin. Many people are familiar, for example, with epoxy resins or polyester resins. If you use super glue at home, this is a thermoset resin. So you mix two components. There's a little chemical reaction happening. The material sets, becomes hard, and you cannot change the shape of it anymore. The other type of polymer we often use are thermoplastics. And as the name suggests, those are materials that you can change the shape of when you heat them up. They have what we call a glass transition temperature. After, if you exceed this, they become very soft and malleable. And of course, they can also melt. And then you can really, really easily reshape them in any way you like. And so those thermoplastics are what we typically make our water bottles out of, our plastic trays, plastic cutlery, all those things. And those are also the ones that are much easier to recycle because we can just melt them again. And then when we talk about composites, what we typically mean here is a polymer that is reinforced by something, or if it's not reinforced, at least filled. The terms are slightly different, because if we fill a polymer, what we mean is we use a particle. And for example, let's say sawdust. We can put sawdust into a polymer, then we have filled the polymer with sawdust. That changes the properties, but it typically doesn't improve the properties much. What you do is you save the polymer and you use a material that is otherwise waste. So you're reducing the cost. You're changing the appearance because it'll look a bit more like wood than it does like plastic, but it hasn't really improved anything. While if we reinforce a polymer, then we add typically fibers. Fibers are much stronger typically than the polymer itself. And so when you add the fibers, the material as a whole becomes a composite as a fiber reinforced polymer. And so those are typically used in where we have materials that need to carry at least some weight, withstand some form of loading, you know. And this goes up to very high performance composites. For example, wind turbine plates are often made now from carbon fiber or glass fiber reinforced thermosets.
Wow, I understood. I'm so happy. It took me quite some time to understand these. And now, without reading, I finally get it. So I'm really happy. But there's one more term I found, and I didn't get it in your description. There's something about the matrix stage of forming a biocomposite or composite?
Yeah, so what we call a matrix is essentially the material that surrounds the filler or reinforcing agent. So in the scenario I described, the matrix is always the polymer, and the fiber is then the fiber, or could be a particle like a sawdust.
So now that we know what composites are and biocomposites in your case, for you, what is an ideal biocomposite?
Oh, what a difficult question to answer. I don't think there is such a thing as an ideal material. Materials are agnostic, right? Materials need to do the job they were selected to do. What I would like to see more of course, are biocomposites that highlight the fact that they are biocomposites. So coming back to the car industry, they have been using biocomposites. And when we say biocomposites, what we typically mean is a biological material put into a polymer that is not natural. So typically a thermoplastic, but could also be a thermoset that is reinforced by a natural fiber. In Europe, it's often flax or filled with, for example, a wood-based particle. Those biocomposites have been used for a long time, but often you wouldn't know. You would sit in a car, and it could be that many of the parts around you, of the panels and the doors, for example, are made from a biocomposite, but you didn't see it because the manufacturers were worried that if people see it, they would not like it. And the ideal biocomposite to me is a composite that stands proudly as a biocomposite. So where you can see that there are natural fibers in there, where you can see that there's a natural material in there, because to me, there's beauty in it. And now we actually see some companies also working with this principle.
And big question is, I guess, what is to be shown? Because once again, we're coming back to the same thing. If you show too much, then people think this is now whatever the students were saying.
Yeah, I mean, the students also looked at other biocomposites and they really liked them. You know, so the question
is, there's hope.
There is certainly hope. And there is more than hope. There is a little bit of method to the madness, I would say. So what we actually have found in the research that we've done so far, and I should say this is research really done by my former PhD student Manu in New Zealand, who's just about to graduate, is that we can now identify certain aspects of a biocomposite. There could be things like, how much of the fibers do you see? How aligned are the fibers? How regular is the pattern of the fibers? So, for example, you can have fibers very randomly aligned, so they're all over, pointing in all directions, or you can have them in the weave, so like a textile, so that you can clearly see there's a toe going left and a toe going up. And that makes a huge difference for how those materials are perceived. Color is, of course, important, but within limits, nature has a great palette. You know, there's a lot of brown, but they come in lots of different shapes, those browns as well. And you can play with this as well. And then finally, there's also things like the roughness of the material that make a huge difference. Typically, we perceive a little bit of roughness as more pleasurable than something that is very smooth but dull. This changes. If things become very glossy, we typically like glossy and smooth, but we don't typically perceive that as natural. So it's a question you'd have to figure out for the application you have in mind, which are those combinations you want. But with, I'd say, about 75 to 90% accuracy, we think we can predict how a material will be perceived based on the attributes of that make up the material.
I guess my listeners can already notice that you are kind of in between two different worlds, right? So we're discussing material science, but we're also discussing a lot of product design. And it's because before Liszt, you worked at the School of Product Design. So you kind of crossed the Rubicon in a way, right? You were on the other side. So just tell us a little bit about that experience. How was it? And do you miss that? How is it now with being more on the engineering side?
It was certainly mind-blowing in the best possible way. And maybe also sometimes in difficult ways. Designers and engineers, they use a very different vocabulary. So when I talk to an engineer, things are fairly straightforward. You know, we use the same terms to mean the same things. We all think more or less along the same lines. So conversations typically are easy unless, you know, you're discussing details and technicalities. While with a designer, designers think differently. They look at the world differently to an engineer. And so it is a challenge to understand this. But you have to, otherwise you cannot have a conversation. And those conversations need to happen because only when a designer talks to an engineer, you can really come up with a great product, I think. So I do miss it because it's a challenge to myself to look at the world differently. And it's as much a challenge as it would be talking to a social scientist, you know, or to a medical scientist. People are not, I think, aware how much they embed themselves in the way of thinking in a certain jargon and within their discipline after 5, 10, 20 years of work. And so it's very interesting to try and open those doors from any direction. I really like the work we're doing at List as well, though, because here we're really working with companies and we get the requirements of the industry. So what we can do with our work is we can really direct it to make a difference. You know, we are much closer now at List than I was working at the university to have a material that will be used in a product that will, you know, be purchasable by people within the next 5 years, maybe, or 10 years. And that's certainly very exciting and appealing to me as well.
So how does it work? Because you mentioned that, okay, if you're a product designer, you have this list of products you can go through, but the materials you design at List will not be on the list, right? They are kind of more designed for a company.
Yeah. And so I guess most companies that we work with, they have not really considered the aesthetic aspects of the material. They are interested in the technical performance, and that makes a lot of sense. Most materials that we use are not even visible, so technical performance dominates. And so there, what we're typically trying to do is match those requirements. A company might say, I'm using this product, but I know the polymer that I'm using for it is not sustainable, and I would like to replace that with something. Can you help me? And then we'll try, right? So then we say, okay, we've developed this formulation. If we change this, add this, process it in a certain way, we're getting very close to the property profile you want, and then you could pick this material up and use it instead of the one you've been using so far. While those designers, when they select the material, the big problem is they do not know that those novel materials exist, right? And there is a lot of work going on into developing new materials. There's thousands of them being developed every year. But yes, the problem is the designers do not know they exist. The designer, like many other people in many other professions, while surely open-minded, are also conservative. They like to use what they know does work. And so when they see a new material, many of them are a bit skeptical about, well, does that really do what I wanted to do? Yeah, it looks cool, but can we process it the right way? Can we shape it in a way that we want? And so those are still big barriers to material adaption. And that's before we even think about the price. It's just you need to make the material attractive. You need to make them interesting to people. And that does not happen currently.
And I guess it's also a question of, you know, innovation. If you're already innovating in the field of the product itself, going another step and innovating also with the material, it's creating a huge barrier of, okay, maybe this is too much of a risk that I'm introducing.
Exactly. Like, and the rules for designers is only ever change one thing at a time, because, you know, people like change, but only to some extent, you know, and there are many products that have failed because they were a bit too modern, a bit too ambitious, and maybe just not in the right place at the right time. And so hitting this balance is incredibly difficult.
And I guess this leads us to the failure that we discussed at a certain moment in the pub quiz question, right? So, Tim, can you remind us what the question is and then give us the answer?
So my question was, how many products do you think fail because of poor material selection? And the answer to this is up to 65% of developed products fail because the materials used for them was not selected correctly. This is not only related to aesthetics. A very small portion of that is, of course, related to aesthetics. But nonetheless, it stands true that if you are designing a product and developing a product, you need to think very carefully about the materials you're using for this.
So is it because the properties were not tested correctly? The people who created the material claimed something that was not true? Or What's the discrepancy?
That is certainly some of the reasons. I think what often happens is, for example, that some properties are not tested for at all. And that might be because there are no standardized tests for it. So many products, if I look at your drinking cup, for example, it's very organically shaped. It has nice curvature. And that makes it very difficult from an engineering point of view to predict exactly where this material it's used for it will fail. So we can run simulations. We can do lots of standardized testing. We can even test the bottle as it is for 10,000 times. But again, as I mentioned before, those are very expensive tests. And sometimes you just don't have the capacity to do those in advance. So you look up the standard properties and you think it's probably going to be okay. And then maybe you'll find out it isn't. Then what also often happens is that the designer did not think carefully enough with the product design specifications. For example, many materials, if not all materials, are very sensitive to moisture and temperature. Right? Biomaterials more so than man-made materials. And so if you don't think carefully about the temperature range you want to use your material in, then it might just not behave correctly when it gets too cold, or it might get a bit too soft or too weak when it gets too hot, and things just start failing. And so there you need to be very careful when you set up your requirements.
So I think we can wrap up the discussion with kind of two appeals, if I were to summarize what you're saying. First of all, designers, think carefully of your materials and choose something maybe outside of the box. Why not? And then to the engineers, well, why don't you also think about whether the material is beautiful or not?
I like this. I would add, designers, talk to the engineers. They know a lot of stuff, and even if they sometimes are a little bit difficult to talk to, it's often worth your while. And for the engineers, absolutely. Think about if you interact with the material, how does that make you feel? I know we don't like talking about feelings and thinking about our feelings in the engineering world, but they are important, and they make a lot of decisions for us. So think about that as well.
Okay, and with that, thank you very much, Tim, for coming today. This was a really interesting discussion.
Thank you very much.
And this is it for today. Don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to write what you thought about the episode, suggest next guests, and follow us on all the social media where we're present. This was Silux, and my name is Hanna Siemaszko.